Chapter 6. Kral took an unmarked atmospheric transport east. He pulled it high, out of the greater mass of traffic, and up into the zone where the summits of the lesser spires grazed the clouds. From such a vantage, one could see wide areas of the cityscape unfurl, a drear, majestic clutter of competing pinnacles, striving towards the light that never quite broke through the stratospheric cover. Over to the north, a long way distant, was the steadily rising continent mass of the Imperial Palace. To the south was the wide open sprawl of the major worker conurbations, kilometre after kilometre of tightly packed habitation units. Ahead of him lay more industrial zones, some derelict, some very much in operation, all adding to the snarls of coal-black grime whispering up through the high, hot airs.
"Two Maltas,"
observed Gorgias, gloomily, floating up to the transport's viewport and gazing downward.
"More of it."
Kral said nothing, but the skull was right. The period of Sanguinala had been restive and unruly, but that was part deliberate, a chance for the long-suffering populace to let off a little steam. Now that it was all over, things should have reverted to the long-run type, a dull, suppressed tension, locked down by fear and hard labour. Instead, the Arbites were out in force everywhere, and there were fires burning on the southern horizon. Or perhaps he was imagining things. He felt slow from lack of sleep, and glanding narcotics could only go so far to remedy that. Perhaps he should have brought Rivas with him, or even Spinoza, but then the subterfuge would have been that much harder. It was best, in general, to keep things as simple as possible. A part of him was even looking forward to it. A return to older, more secret ways, unable to rely on the terror-inducing power of his rosette, and dependent on older powers of deception and misdirection. He had equipment and resources to aid him, of course, but at its foundation, this was a human skill, one that had existed for as long as the species had. After a few hours of sustained flying, the object of his journey appeared on the eastern horizon. Just as the Imperial Palace itself emerged from the press of lesser buildings, like a grand massif rising up from a tangled forest, so the Nexus Axiomatic swelled up into vastness from the urban confusion around it. There was no beauty to this place, even of a dilapidated sort. The Nexus was a pale grey rockcrete hunk, obese and streaked with old dirt, sunk heavily amid its feeder slums, like some grotesque nursing mother. A brace of massive comms towers soared above it, great skeletons of wind-blasted iron studded with sensor clusters and relays. Its summit was further disfigured by jumbled layers of landing stages, some very ancient, some merely centuries old. Terra's air traffic, always congested, thickened around that monolithic structure like flies on a carcass. Big orbital landers processed from the upper landing pads in regulated columns, punching through the clouds above the Nexus and making them curdle and split. Unusually, there were few Arbites craft present in those airways, though there were plenty of other armed vessels prowling the perimeters, most liveried in the midnight blue of the Speaker's own security forces. Just as was the case elsewhere on the throne world, this was another kingdom in all but name, a fiefdom carved from the Eternal City by immortal precedent and timeless statute. Many institutions on this world were older then than the Imperium itself, and the Nexus Axiomatic was one of them. Its ancestor bodies had existed in the time before recorded history, stretching back into the legendary age before the Great Crusade, when humanity's soul had rotted amid a heretical age of technological wonder. The very first charters given to merchant fleets were still preserved under stasis fields in there, it was rumoured, each one tens of thousands of years old. Every hereditary charter since had been ultimately issued from the same location, and over the millennia the numbers had exploded exponentially, such that the Nexus now housed billions of individual screeds and documents and testimonies and amendments, all cross-referenced and counter-stamped and stored in vacuum-sealed depositories. Every void-capable civilian ship in the entire Imperium, save for those esoteric leviathans falling under the purview of Mars, had its legal origin here, no matter where its hull had been laid down or where it plied its trade. Every prescribed trade route was fixed here. Every statistic on transportation, tithe collection, and inter-system trade eventually found its way here too, where the data was pored over and scrutinized by teams of adepts 1,000 strong, all to ensure that raw materials found their way to forge worlds, foodstuffs found their way to ravenous mouths, commercial goods found their way to rich hive worlds, and weaponry found its way to the Imperium's endlessly shifting battlefronts. The original Nexus had been built on this site, it was believed, though no trace of that first building remained. Subsequent iterations had been constructed atop scoured walls, rising like so many of the great edifices on this world, over the bones of their predecessors. During the inferno of the Great Heresy, the Nexus had been almost completely destroyed, though such was the institution's importance that many of its records had been spirited away long before the arch-traitor had made planetfall. In the centuries afterwards, in that strange twilight age, when so much was at once lost and reborn, its current colossal foundations were laid, and the gargantuan chambers slowly erected. The records returned to the inner vaults, where they had remained ever since, and the mind-bending task of renewing and reissuing and revoking charters recommenced. The Speaker, who had long since been a powerful figure in the politics of the early Imperium, took up residence within this rapidly expanding palace, garrison, archive, and, conscious of what had almost been lost, created an army of guardians to police their new realm. In an Imperium already swollen with overlapping and competing armed bodies, the Praeses Mercatura emerged to oversee this high cathedral of trade and commerce, taking command of old weapons and old technology and hoarding it all jealously. It was not perhaps the most prestigious of the high offices of state, but due to its proximity to the enormous system of tithe collection, the Speaker's kingdom was wealthy beyond imagination, and competition to succeed the current incumbent was always fierce and often bloody. Crowell had known all this for a long time. Over the course of his long career, he had had occasional dealings with charter holders and their masters. The captain of a big void hauler was a powerful person, and to lose one to corruption was a serious matter. That being the case, he had never had reason to probe the source itself. If he had, even in more normal times, he might have thought twice about how to proceed. A High Lord was a High Lord, and for all Spinoza's protestations of rectitude, none of those occupying a place at the high table in the Senatorum had got there by being shy of deploying lethal force. Whatever the rhetoric, that was not how the Imperium had ever operated.
"Immanis,"
remarked Gorgias, sounding a little cowed for once.
"Yes, very big," agreed Crowell, staring out of the forward viewers. "Some coin's been spent here."
By then, they were heading toward one of the many ingress points. The pale grey walls filled the entirety of the sky before them, blotting out the jagged towerscape beyond. Several artificial canyons had been gouged into the outer perimeter, each overlooked by ranks of anti-vessel gunnery. Incoming transports filtered into those canyons, watched the whole time by tracer drones and Mercatura gunships. Once across the threshold, the natural light cut out, plunging them into an artificial dusk broken only faintly by blinking route beacons. The transport shuddered faintly, and a scrutiny lock momentarily took control of the engines. Runes darted across the main console as a watcher script inveigled its way into the vehicle's machine spirit cortex. A few moments later, the transport's hololith column atop the flight console blurted into life, and the ghostly head profile of a Mercatura official spiraled into instantiation.
"Declare," it commanded.
"Inspector Ferdad Kalavine, Sol Sector Command," said Crowell. "Inward bound for a scheduled appointment with Signals Adept Majoris Harker Bajan. Request entry at berth Gamma 56 as arranged by prior communication."
There was a pause. A faint click over the comm line, some evident processing of a cogitator.
"Granted, Inspector," came the eventual response. "Proceed to nominated berth. Welcome back to Terra."
The hololith flickered out. Crowell smiled.
"Thanks very much," he murmured,
and guided the transport further in, following a blinking line of guide nodes that now sprung up across the forward scanner lens. The last of the grey sunlight fell away, leaving them in near-total darkness. Their allotted berth swam up towards them, just one of hundreds ranked against the walls ahead. The berths held transports inside clawed metal fingers, from which umbilicals led back into a complex lattice of metal and stone beyond. This canyon alone could have held more than 1,000 vehicles, and there were many others. Spider-like servitors crawled across the entire surface, their spines sprouting lasguns, probing and testing. Great booms and crashes rang out, echoing up the long cleft, as larger craft docked or were released. And then it was their turn. As metal struts unfolded to greet them, sucking them in towards a circular aperture, enclosing them in prehensile iron fronds crowned by sensor spikes and hull drills. The transport shuddered, its engines extinguished, and then it clanged to a halt, locked fast against the canyon's inner wall. Crowell waited for a moment, letting the remote systems do their work. The transport's machine spirit was still being interrogated hard, and no doubt the spiders would be paying a visit to the outer hulls soon enough. Gorgias darted back and forth across the cabin interior, angling his oculus to try to get a view of the outside.
"Doing damage,"
he hissed, watching the hull drill scrape across the transport's flank.
"Careless! Ridicolo!"
Crowell got up, pulling the black jacket of his inspectorate uniform down and donning the high-peaked cap. His face had been rearranged with surface prosthetics and a gesture lattice that would fool all but the most determined scrutiny. His garb was nowhere near as protective as his usual armour, but the chain mesh underlayer and stiff outer surface offered at least a modicum of reassurance. He had an inspectorate-issue las pistol in open display on his belt, and other, certainly not inspectorate-issue weapons hidden in sensor-reflective caches within. He was as prepared as he would ever be, and managed to walk up to the transport's outer doors with only the faintest limp evident. The shielding cracked open and rolled away, to reveal a blue-light-tinged interior and a pronounced smell of antisepsis chems. A circular umbilical lay ahead, polished and clean, but there was no one in it to welcome him, as there should have been. Crowell stood alone for a moment, wondering if something had gone wrong. If he had been discovered so soon, this was the last chance to retreat back into the transport and attempt to break out again. Eventually, though, a circular portal revolved open at the far end of the umbilical, and five figures emerged into the lumens, four masked soldiers of the Mercatura and a single official in dark blue robes. The official had a smooth, young face with little sign of augmetics. His forehead bore the tattooed mark of the Speaker's Kingdom, the ancient star and quill of the old Void Charterers. He looked disturbingly similar to his ultimate mistress, Danda, though right now he was failing to hide a certain degree of agitation, and his skin was flushed at his collar.
"Welcome to the Nexus, Inspector," said the man, who Crowell recognised from Calavine's private records as Harker Bajan. "I apologise for the delay. We're busy. My private secretary has been taken ill. We're still catching up." "You don't have a replacement?"
Crowell asked, sceptically.
"As of 2 days ago. She's still learning."
Bajan stepped aside, gesturing for Crowell to join him.
"I trust your journey was satisfactory. Warp stage from Altera Commodus, was it, this time?"
"Volese," said Crowell snappily, striding out ahead, knowing more about Calavine's actual and intended movements than anyone living, and supremely unconcerned about such cursory attempts to trip him up.
"And it was as filthy as ever, so let's get this started. I do not have time to waste."
Raw commodities were the lifeblood of the throne world. It was often said, and widely believed, that Terra made nothing and consumed everything. And though that maxim captured the fundamental balance between humanity's birthplace and the rest of its domains, it was not quite correct. Manufactoria on Terra still produced plenty of specialized items, but given the all-devouring press of the choking conurbations across such limited land space, they rarely had direct access to the raw materials they needed. There was no agriculture or extractive industry to keep them fueled. All such primary inputs had to be shipped in by the colossal merchant fleets that forever plied the voidways of the Sol system. Primary amongst these were, of course, the ores and the alloys required for the maintenance of the nigh-infinite urban fabric, as well as the freeze-packed carcasses ready to be rendered down for consumption by the equally infinite tide of workers. A bewildering array of other items were imported daily, the sustained lack of any one of which would have swiftly crippled life on this uniquely thirsty, greedy, and insatiable world. One object of particular importance was scarcely present in the imaginations of that ignorant citizenry. Young charges of the Scolae, when asked to guess which was the seventh most vital import to Holy Terra by weight, almost never landed on the right answer. And yet, the chances were that the product of that importation was staring them in the face, marked with their own scrawl and stamped with the crest of their particular educational establishment. Parchment, vellum, animal hide. For millennia, it had been the choice material of record throughout the scriptoria of the Imperium. Far more durable than paper, much cheaper than crystal plate or data slab, less ideologically suspect than cogitator wafer, and harder to tamper with than Ordex screeds, parchment remained the medium trusted by scribes on worlds from Ultramar to Hydroper. It was inefficient, to be sure, and prone to error in onward copy transmission, and yet it still persisted, clung to by a savant class so wedded to its smells, its texture, its permanence, and its cheapness, that the mere suggestion of another method of record-keeping skirted close to a kind of heresy of its own. After so long in use, the infrastructure of vellum creation had become mind-bendingly vast, spread out across every industrial world in mankind's sprawling possessions. There were whispers in the Imperium's famed archive worlds of entire wars fought over its production and distribution. 500 years ago, the great master of the administratum, Scito Gavalis, had been asked what would make his onerous job more bearable.
"Pigskin," he was said to have replied. "More pigskin."
Of course, few living humans had ever laid eyes on a porcine. Unless they worked on an agri-world, they would never have encountered one of those bloated and obese sacks of stim-injected muscle and sinew, too colossal to walk without breaking their spindly legs, and force-fed high-nutrient chem soup to keep them growing in the pens. They would never have come across a bovine, either, unless you counted the thready strands of protein extract pumped into their ration trays during sanctioned rest breaks. Such things were legends, in much the same category as relics of the saints, the angels of death, or manifest acts of the emperor, things that definitely existed, but were unlikely ever to be encountered. The bulk of vellum used throughout the Imperium was not, of course, taken from such sources. Most of it was grown from stock genetic material in biotanks, then cured in kilometre-long reams before being sliced, rolled, and pressed for delivery. Such stuff was hardy, inexpensive, and plentiful, the perfect qualities for a culture that prized quantity and uniformity above all things. For a few senior scribes, though, that was not quite good enough. They wanted to run their autoquills across the hide of something once living. They wanted the iron tips to snag and catch on patches where hair had grown, or where a blood vessel had wriggled. They wanted their documents to look like the ones in the mighty tomes of the past, bound in real leather and lined with gold before being locked into vacuum capsules and buried deep in alarm-rigged vaults. Whether bulk-produced or specialised, Terra alone sucked in more imports of vellum than an entire subsector of less exalted territory. Its scriptoria were the oldest and the most famed, steeped in traditions so ancient that their origins had taken on the lustre of true myth. In the greatest of such places, entire spire pinnacles were given over to the business of inscribing, illuminating, copying, recopying, redacting, interpreting, and compiling. Rows of lamplit desks, stretching far into the smoky darkness, were fully occupied by cowled scribes, their scrawny grey hands clutching steel-tipped quills, their augmetic eyepieces zooming and panning before committing ink to parchment. Every tithe paid was recorded, every report from every battle was recorded, every court hearing was recorded, and every heretic's confession was recorded. It was all then stashed away in the mountainous repositories, tended by skulls and servitors, where it slowly moulded, part of the landslide of unread testimony that would one day stifle its creators. For the connoisseurs, the final processing of real vellum was done on Terra. Batches of unfinished stock were airlifted to the few remaining manufactoria, where they were unloaded, scrutinised for quality, doused, scraped, then hung on iron hooks until the characteristic stretched surface was obtained. Entire families were devoted to such work, and in some places production could be reliably dated back thousands of years at the same site, with the same bloodline and the same equipment. Mordant was one such place. It was housed in a run-down industrial zone, overlooked on all sides by the soaring flanks of Promethium refineries, making the air more smuts than oxygen. Its antiquarian buildings were ramshackle and overlapping, a confusing jumble of steep-pitched iron-tiled roofs and piped extractor housings. Gouts of steam from the settlement tanks rose up above them all, before pooling in a fog of milky condensation, swirling about the sensor veins like the mists of some primordial forest. Rivas took his shade in close, setting it down amid a berth already occupied by several big orbital landers. Each of those was marked with the Gothic M of the Mordant brand, and were as well appointed and maintained as any such vessels ever were. A few service menials and servitors were working in the semi-darkness as he got out, hammering at open engine hatches, or guiding in heaps of unfinished material on grav loaders. None of them paid him much attention, and he walked into the facility without challenge. Inside, the air was humid and stinking. Orderlies bustled along high gantries, wearing stiff aprons, their faces hidden behind environment masks. Enormous vats bubbled, over which hung chains and hook lines in a seething atmosphere of chemical vapours. Servitors with engorged upper bodies lumbered past him, hauling drums of solvents and metal pallets for onward distribution, their faces riveted with blinkers and their mouths clamped closed with permanent tox filters. The far end of the chamber was entirely lost in hissing pools of steam, but Rivas guessed this was just the start of the production line. From somewhere, he could hear what sounded like animal screams, which indicated, however improbably, that some living creatures had been brought here for slaughter and processing. He made his way up pressed metal stairways, higher and higher, until he was far above the vat level. Long rows of administratum chambers ran under the eaves of the facility's steep roofline, angled between the tangle of bracings and loader crane supports. One of them, slightly larger than the others, was marked with a sodium lumen panel indicating the site foreman. Rivas headed for that one and pushed the door open. The room beyond was occupied by a single figure, a fat man with a bald pate and bottle lenses suckered over his eyes. He was surrounded by tottering heaps of rotting vellum, most of which had been shoved around and atop a single creaking cogitator unit housed in a chipped pea-green metal casing. Old protein ration casings littered the floor, and the place smelled strongly of meat. An electro-date reckoner hung on the far wall, showing the standard Terran measure from 40 years ago. There was a plastic figurine of St. Alicia Dominicia on a side table amid a few burned-out tallow candles and a greasy pict screen showing cycle images of sun-drenched paradise worlds. As Rivas entered, the fat man looked up and went white and sweatier.
"Look, I spoke to the adept from the Sector Tithe office last week," he said. "We explained everything then." "I am looking for Elia Rudiger," said Rivas, "one of your technicians."
The fat man blanched even more, his chubby fingers, stained with ink, pressed together into a cat's cradle.
"Rudiger," he repeated. "Who are you, then? I'll need to see an ident."
Rivas let his gaze run idly over the clutter.
"No, you won't," he said, and waited.
It didn't take the man long, even in the murk, to spot the stormtrooper insignia on his breast, and that made things quicker.
Then she must be in her hab still," he offered, uncertainly. "She's not reported in for several days. I meant to arrange a discipline schedule, but we've been overwhelmed with this tithe misunderstanding, and so..."
"You did not inquire after her welfare?"
The man squirmed.
"I meant to, but..."
"Where is her hab?"
"Next level along, Unit 4534, though..."
"I was not here. We did not have this conversation."
"But I..."
"You have a successful operation here. You do not want to waste it."
"No, it..."
"Clean this place and yourself up. Both are a disgrace."
Rivas turned on his heel and walked out of the chamber, closing the door behind him firmly. From there, he walked along the gantry corridor, glancing down at the churning vats below. Further down the production lines, sheets of bleached and hairless hides were being hauled out of the chemical baths by creaking knuckle-boom cranes, then swung around to be pinned to ranks of drying racks, each one mounted on mobile gurneys and propelled by more bulked-up servitors. High-ranking workers with shiny black protective suits and wearing oculi patrolled the long rows with flensing knives, scouring the pinned parchment sheets. Further on still, members of another labour caste prepared dies and branding irons for the finished pieces. None of them looked up. For all they were concerned, this cubicle of curing and stretching and pinning might have been the entire world. Rivas's route took him away from it all soon enough, following a bridge over the industrial chasm below, 100 meters down a connective gangway, and back into the more utilitarian surroundings of a standard hab block. After passing through a stuffy transition hall and taking an elevator 6 levels up, he found himself in one of those corridors that could have been anywhere on Terra. Lightless, airless, stained with the smells of refuse and pockmarked with individual hab unit doorways. He walked along until he found the one he wanted. As he went, the lone fly-blown lumen popped on and off, as if marking time. A door slid open further down, and a straggle-bearded, emaciated face emerged. Its owner looked at him for a moment with startled, red-rimmed eyes before blurting,
"And shall he be ever watchful in these times?"
and retreating rapidly. Alone again, Rivas faced the doorway to Unit 4534. He ran a quick scan for heat signatures on the far side and got nothing. He stood to one side and pressed the entry chime. Still nothing. He drew his las pistol in his right hand and took out a lock tumbler with his left. The device clamped onto the cheap fittings of the doorway, whirred for a second or two, then clicked it open. He went in. The layout was standard for a worker of Rudica's station. Living chamber, bed chamber, hygiene chamber. The lumens were out, so he activated his night sights and closed the door behind him. The first room, the living chamber, was intact and tidy. A single table stood against the far wall with the remains of a meal on it. A single plasfiber couch, threadbare from use, faced a picture unit that had been powered down. Hired vid capsules were arranged on top of it. Nothing unusual, just the standard motivational fare. He could hear thudding footsteps from the unit above, only barely muffled by the poor soundproofing. From somewhere below came the tinny hiss of a music player running through military band standards. It smelled badly, a smell Rivas was all too familiar with. Keeping his las pistol tracking ahead, he gently eased the door to the bedchamber open. A double-width cot stood in the far corner, its sheets tangled. Elia Rudica lay half propped up against a broken headboard, her grey face slumped onto her chest. Her tunic was soaked with blood from a single torso shot. She had a gun of her own in her right hand, a Kallax R4 single-action revolver. Rivas looked around, seeing a messy burst of blood on the opposite wall and a spotty trail of it on the floor leading to the hygiene chamber. He went over to the corpse and blink-clicked for a helm scan of her exposed right arm. The flesh was grey, cold and still stiff, indicating death within the last few standard days. He twisted the revolver out of her grip and checked the chamber. A single bullet was missing. He took pics of the scene, then moved towards the hygiene chamber. The door mechanism was faulty and he had to manually haul it open. The space on the far side was tiny. A washstand, pulse shower unit, and lavatory. Rudica had draped her lumen housing, also blown, with a collection of prayer beads. Grainy, printed pics of what Rivas took to be her legal parents and work acquaintances had been pinned around the cracked mirror. They looked vivacious and agreeable. The dead man lying in her pulse shower cubicle, on the other hand, did not. Rivas stowed his weapon and squatted down to examine the corpse. This one, too, had a single gunshot wound just below his shoulder. He had dropped his own weapon, a more powerful Hammerglave VX projectile pistol, into the shower pan, where it lay atop a dry pool of his own blood. He was wearing basic mesh protective gear, but nothing extravagant, and evidently insufficient to stop a Kallax fired at close range. His head had rolled back, exposing the snow-grey flesh of his neck under a close-fitting helm. No sigils adorned his armour. The pattern was not distinctive. Any hired operative would have access to similar. Rivas lifted the man's jacket, searched the pockets of his fatigues. Nothing. He pulled a glove off and took a fingerprint scan, then removed the helm and did the same with the eyeball. It was unlikely anything here would find a match with Hook's records. This had very evidently not been a sophisticated hit, and the man almost certainly was not known to Corvain's systems. He was, in all probability, some underhive trash, gifted a gun and a mission, as anonymous in death as he had been in life. The chances of getting something substantive out of it all were slight, and there were other avenues still to check. And yet, Rudica had been an informant for both Crowell and Gloch, and Rudica was now dead. Rivas activated the secure link to Corvain. "Yes, Captain," came Anila's crisp voice.
"Clean up, team, to my coordinates," said Rivas,
standing up and activating his lock beacon.
"Two bodies to bring in. Primerunian for study when we get back. We'll need to take a closer look at this."